8 a.m. having arrived, I'm going to call the Committee on Taxes to order. And Representative Petersburg and Chair Davids, I've been reading the report, seeing the newspaper. You had quite a storm down south. Yes. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We did have a lot of blowing wind, and it wasn't coming from St. Paul, the wind direction. So it was something else. But, yeah, it really blew around. But Chair Davids here had worse. I think they had like 13 inches of snow. So,
Representative Davids.
They call it the storm of the century, and I kind of believe it. I had testifiers were supposed to be up yesterday in a committee, and I told them to stay home. But yet I ventured out, and there was four areas where it was blocked except a little narrow alley to get through on a major U.S. highway. So it was very bad, and so a lot of cars in the ditch, but mine wasn't. So that's a good thing. I guess that's what they build F-150s for.
Yeah.
Well, I saw Representative Carlson.
I was just going to say that we ran Ways and Means overtime yesterday so that Representative Davids could make it.
That is... Well, today I saw a picture where a train.
That's a true statement, but it's overtime, but he didn't.
I know Representative Davids made that through thick and thin. And I saw a picture of a train that was stuck in the snow, and another train that had come to try to get out also got stuck. So I don't think we've seen storms like this for a while.
Yeah.
But
Mr. Chairman, it's amazing what 58 mile an hour winds and 13 inches of snow will do.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's good to see you all here.
I taught in southern Minnesota down by Rochester in 64, 65, and there was a storm that was very much like this in 1965. Semis and stuff all up and down the old Highway 14, just they couldn't move at all. The town I taught in was St. Charles, and people sleeping in the gas station, restaurants, all along the highway there. So I don't know if it was as bad as this one or not, but southern Minnesota has been hard hit before.
Well, as far as I have heard, there's been no casualties or anything, thank goodness. So, Representative Davids.
St. Charles Saints.
The St. Charles Saints.
We keep track of the...
I know. Members, we do have a quorum. And so the first order of business is I'm going to, does anyone want to move the February 21st, 2019 minutes? Representative Les Lagarde moves approval of the February 21st, 2019 minutes. Any discussion on those? Seeing none, I'm going to call for the vote on those minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion carries. The February 21st, 2019 minutes are approved. Members, we also have some bill referrals. If you take a look, there's a handout here on a number of bills that are being referred to the Property and Local Tax Division that were referred to that division. So with that, members, we are going to change our order a little bit because Representative O'Neill has another committee that she is working in. So without objection, we are going to start with House File 1356. And would someone like to move House File 1356? Representative Erickson moves House File 1356 for possible inclusion into the tax omnibus bill.
Any amendments? Why can't O'Neill do it?
No amendments.
Oh, yeah, O'Neill could do our own bill.
So, yeah. That's...
Yes. Mr. Chair, I'll rescind my motion so she can do hers.
Very good. Representative Erickson rescinds her motion, so when Representative O'Neill gets organized here, I'll let her move her bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File
1356. Very good. Representative O'Neill moves House File 1356 for possible inclusion into the tax omnibus bill. Representative O'Neill, please proceed, and I see you have some witnesses also.
I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So House File 1356 is a sales tax exemption provision for a new building that they want to build in Monticello in my district to do a new fire station. And that's I'm going to turn it over to the testifier so they can tell you about the need of the fire station and just a little bit about Monticello, and I'm very grateful that they came I'm not sure how many minutes or hours it took them to get here. It depends, you know, again, on the weather. It's, sometimes it's an hour and a few minutes, and sometimes it's three. We have a flake of snow, so I'm very grateful to be joined today by City Administrator and our Fire Chief and a couple and another fireman. So I'll turn it over to them, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Welcome. If you would just please state your name and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jeff O'Neill. I'm City Administrator for the City of Monticello, and I'd like to thank Marion for sponsoring, authoring this bill, and the committee for hearing it as well. And I'd also like to thank the City of Inver Grove Heights for kind of paving the way, because what we're asking for is very similar to what has been reviewed by this committee. Accompanying me is, of course, Mike Mossy, our fire chief, and Dan Kleiner, fire marshal. And Mike is going to give a little bit of a rundown on the project itself, what's involved. And again, really appreciate the opportunity to stretch our public safety dollars further through this legislation. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Mike for some comments.
Very good. Chief Mossy, welcome. Please state your name and begin with your testimony, please.
Good morning. I'm Mike Mossy, the fire chief for the City of Monticello. Excuse me. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'd like to thank you for this opportunity this morning. I just want to give you a brief summary of our department, as well as the new fire station project that we are working on currently. The Monticello Fire Department consists of 30 paid on-call members. We do have one full-time fire marshal and emergency manager. We average about 275 calls per year for service, and most of those are for fire and rescue calls. We do not run medicals, as we have a hospital in the City of Monticello owned by CentraCare that has an ambulance service there. We serve just over 68 square miles in our district. The service area includes 8.9 square miles within the city itself, two local townships, and a 13-mile stretch of Interstate 94, a section of State Highway 25. The Mississippi River creates its entire north boundary, and we also have the Monticello Nuclear Power Generating Plant on the west side of our city. In addition to responding to calls for the local community, the Monticello Fire Department assists the traveling public with emergencies on I-94. Approximately 20% of all of our calls and those responses are for those incidents on I-94. Those calls include mostly accidents involving injuries, vehicle fires, and occasionally grass fires in that area. The current fire station that we have now was built approximately 40 years ago. And since that time, the city has tripled its population, and the overall service area has grown as well. The City of Monticello is in a good position for continued growth in the coming future. We completed a study in 2017 by a third party that noted significant space needs for our fire department. The city utilized a committee to decide between expanding our current fire station or building a completely new station. After analyzing the costs and the growth trends in the area, the city ultimately decided that a new building in a different location would be the greatest benefit to the department and the people that it serves. This new station will be located on the other side of I-94 from where it currently is, and it will be located at 103 Chelsea Road, which is just on the south side of I-94, and it's in the very close to the center of our city limits. The reason we chose that this new site is it's in a central location to where the growth will occur. Like I said, the northern part of our city has a boundary of the Mississippi River, and the east side towards Elberville and as you head towards the cities is already fairly developed. So we expect the future growth of the city to go south and slightly west as well. This location also has great access to I-94. Just recently put a new overpass over to I-94 there that helps us get across 94, which can be a challenge in the summer months with all the traffic that we see through the City of Monticello. This new building that we're proposing to build is 23,230 square feet, which is almost triple the size that we have now. It does consist of a second floor that's going to be future expansion space, and it will not be built out right away. The new building will incorporate some newer technology for decontamination of our equipment as well as our fire gear. It includes an emergency operations center for the city. We have been working in the past few years on a in cooperation with the Wright County Emergency Management Team for large-scale incidents in our area. It also greatly increases our vehicle storage, as right now we're very pressed for storage space for our larger vehicles. The construction costs for this new project is set to be around $4.1 million, and the total cost of the entire project is approximately $5.6 million. The City of Monticello has been very supportive of us and continues to invest in the fire department. For example, last October, we were able to hire a new full-time fire marshal position that was years in the making. We have also just recently ordered a new ladder truck. And to top it off, we were able to start this construction of our new fire station project this spring. This time, I'm open to any questions that you may have for me.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Chief Mossy? Representative Carlson.
Not related directly to this, but you mentioned the nuclear power plant, and you also mentioned the ability to deal with contamination. Are there additional costs that you incur because of a power plant being there, additional training? Curious as to what's your relationship with Xcel.
Chief Mossy.
Thank you. So that's a great question. We do work very closely with the Monticello Nuclear Power Plant. However, this new fire station, this project doesn't specifically include anything as far as the decontamination, you know, related to the Monticello Nuclear Power Plant. The decontamination equipment and stuff that I was referring to is more specific to our gear and the new awareness of the cancer in the fire service, which is an incredibly important piece of what we're working on with all these new discoveries in the medical field. But as far as the Monticello Nuclear Power Plant, there's nothing specific to that as far as decontamination within this project.
Representative Carlson.
I interpreted when he referenced the power plant and then decontamination to
sure
if there was some issue there, but thank you.
Very good. Any other questions? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious, maybe Ms. Dalton can answer this. On an average per year, other than last year because we didn't have a tax bill, how many of these projects do we usually approve that would offer the tax exemption for materials? Approximately.
A rough ballpark figure.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I would say that we do between 2 and 5 every time we have a tax bill. However, we haven't had a tax bill consistently for the last several years.
Thank you. Any other questions or Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may be a question for Ms. Dalton, too. I'm looking at the fiscal analyst sheet that came out. The second line there, it says Natural Resources and Arts Fund. Can someone explain to me what the $10,000 is there?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, when we exempt something from the sales tax, it affects not only our general fund, but it affects the legacy fund because of the 3/8 cent tax dedicated to that.
Any other questions? Thank you. Did Mr. Klein want to speak, or you're here just for backup and resource? Very good. Thank you. At this time, I want to ask, is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against House File 1356? Seeing none, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to follow up to my question there, this may be a question for the Ways and Means Chair. Your motion today is to lay this bill over for possible inclusion, correct?
Right.
So what happens if somebody in another committee who has oversight over legacy wants to hear the bill, Mr. Chair, from Ways and Means?
Representative Carlson.
That's an interesting question. I suspect that would depend on the desire of the chair of the legacy committee to see the bill. I'd have to ask but when it's in an omnibus bill like this, it generally would be included to one of the divisions like legacy.
And I think
the tax bill is what I
and I think, Ms. Dalton, wouldn't all of our sales tax bills have this impact?
Yes.
Ms.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes. Anything that would change the sales tax base would have an impact on the legacy. there have been times in the past where the bill has essentially made the legacy, the omnibus bill has put money aside to make the legacy fund whole, to make sure that there hadn't been any misallocation of money that they no longer were getting. So that's also a possibility, is to put some one-time money in the omnibus tax bill into the legacy bill to compensate for their losses.
Representative Fabian, thank you, Ms. Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would that be the intention of the Ways and Means Chair, then, to make the legacy fund whole as we go through this process?
Well, Representative Carlson.
Well, Chairman, you just raised the question at this point in time. I would have to think that through, but I would just remind the committee, though, that the tax bill does go through Ways and Means, so there would be the opportunity for a discussion on these issues, I suppose, at that point in time. You know, that's a huge base with the legacy. I guess we could talk with Representative Lilly to see what his thoughts are relative to the cost of a bill like this.
Yeah.
But it would be open for discussion when the tax bill goes through Ways and Means, but the intent would not be to send the tax bill to one of the divisions.
Right.
That's never been done before, at any rate, back when we had the structure with finance.
This year and other years, we'd keep that committee very busy with all of our sales tax bills, but it might be something that when you figure out what the final bill looks like, you could add up those costs and do some sort of, you know, shift or moving money around.
If we were to backfill, we would have to, probably have to come out of the general fund. That would be what we would have available to us, and that would be a target question.
Representative McDonald.
Interesting. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Dalton, so having served on Legacy in one term and then this committee for two terms, or three now, is that has been the practice that we backfill the Legacy funds that we extract during a sales tax exemption? Is that, and if that's the case, is it due to because it's in state statute?
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, the Constitution actually allows, if there is a significant change in the tax base, for the legislature to adjust the legacy tax up or down. No one's ever done that. Generally speaking, there has not been money moved from the general fund into the legacy fund to make them whole. There has been in the 2017 bill, however, because there was some significant money, and there was some information that the legacy fund had spent all of the money that they had originally projected to be in that fund. There was some one-time money put into the legacy fund from the general fund in the omnibus tax bill to basically ensure that nobody had to back out of any approved projects.
Representative McDonald?
No, thank you for clearing that. Very interesting. In that case, in that scenario, that seems to make sense, mm-hmm. But certainly probably not a good policy going forward, but in that scenario, it makes sense. Although there are some projects that are questionable sometimes, right?
Representative Fabian, thanks for bringing that up. No, that's interesting. Hadn't thought about that, and you learn something every day. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not to muddy the waters any more than that, but at one time, the constitutional amendment that was put on, that was approved by the people for the sales tax on auto parts did not include the legacy. And so we did have to make that correction a few years ago to have that adjusted, because otherwise the general fund was having to backfill that amount, because the legacy bill also then included the requirement of every sales tax to be collected. They also include that 3/8%, but the one for the auto parts didn't include it, so there was a conflict there. So it can get very muddy sometimes.
We may have to rename this the Monticello Legacy bill here. very good. Anything else from the committee? If not, Representative O'Neill, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would point out three things that is unique to Monticello. So they do service I-94, which obviously is travelers from other states as well. And, you know, I-94 is a fabulous corridor from the east to west coast. And you've got high traffic, not only commercial traffic, but travelers. So I just wanted to appreciate that 20% of their calls are due to the I-94 corridor. Also, the nuclear power plant, they do, obviously, if there is an emergency, they are, you know, front and center to evacuate people out, and so they do play a great role in that. They, the Monticello Fire Department is incredibly busy, and they have a huge responsibility. The final thing I would say is that the city of Monticello and Wright County as a whole just incurred a very large surprise from the Department of Revenue that we didn't mention earlier, and that is that Xcel Energy used the administrative process instead of tax court and got a change in their valuation for the power plant, and it resulted in a direct drop, dramatic drop, for the revenue for the city of Monticello, a 7% reduction, which is quite substantial. Some of my constituents have found a 25% increase in their property tax as a direct result of that. So I guess what we're asking here is just some deference because, you know, they are trying to serve both the nuclear power plant, the people on the corridor, and, of course, our own constituents. But in so doing, they've been kind of hamstrung just a little bit by the Department of Revenue with the surprise change. Mm-hmm. They did their budget for both the city and the county, and 3 days later found out from Xcel Energy that they had this property valuation change that was immediate. So they had to scramble very quickly. So we've been really hit hard in our community, and I would just ask for your support in this bill moving forward.
Well, thank you very much. And testifiers, thank you so much for coming down today. And Representative O'Neill, renews her motion on House File 1356 to lay over House File 1356 for possible inclusion into the tax omnibus bill. Thank you so much,
thank
Representative.
You,
next up is House File 1357, Representative Schultz. Representative Schultz, would you like to move your bill?
I would like to move my bill.
Representative Schultz moves House File 1357 for possible inclusion into the tax omnibus bill. Thank you so much. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. So this is House File 1357. It would exempt car sharing firms from paying the motor vehicle rental tax and fees in Minnesota. So it exempts all car sharing services from the extra 9.2% short-term motor vehicle sales tax and the 5% fee charged and retained by car rental companies to offset the motor vehicle registration fee. So in Minnesota, the car rental tax is 9.2% plus there's an additional 5% fee for registering vehicles. In addition, there's the general sales tax, which is 6.875% plus other local taxes. So in Minneapolis, taxes on short-term car sharing reservations are around 22%. And according to a study in Chicago, the car sharing's highly taxed status, the rationale was that most people renting a car would be from out of state, so the tax imposition would fall on people that living outside the state as a way to collect revenue. That's not true for car sharing services. Most of those individuals are living within our state, and they're exposed to this high tax rate. So this came to the attention in the tax committee from Pat Dalton, and then I found out that we had introduced a similar bill in 2017. So Senators Scott Dibble and Ann Rest are carrying this in the Senate, and I want to thank my co-author, Representative McDonald, for co-authoring this bill with me today. And I have two testifiers today, Mr. Chair.
That's what I said. Oh.
Thank you very much. And okay, so we'll probably find out. I have some questions, but maybe we'll find this out with the testimony. So welcome, and if you'd please state your name and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chairman and esteemed members of the Tax Committee, my name is Paul Schroeder, and I am the CEO of Our Car, the Twin Cities' original car sharing service and the largest nonprofit car sharing company in the United States. Our Car operates a two-way or return-to-base car sharing service in the Twin Cities. Our fleet of 60 vehicles is embedded in self-service hubs throughout the cities where members can pick up a car, reserve it for as little as half an hour or as long as 3 days, and return it at the end of their trip to the location at which they picked it up. I'm here today on behalf of Our Car's board and staff, as well as our 2,200 members, to testify on behalf of HF 1357. This bill would invigorate car sharing in Minnesota by exempting car sharing companies from the 9.3% motor vehicle rental tax and the 5% motor vehicle rental fee. These taxes, the highest in the nation, have impeded the growth of innovative transportation in Minnesota and caused numerous car-sharing operators to either leave our state or pass over it entirely in favor of more accommodating markets. Exempting car-sharing from these taxes will support the growth of innovative transportation models, making our state more attractive to employers and employees, addressing the lack of transportation options in underserved neighborhoods, and making our communities more vibrant and more connected. As our car's CEO, I can speak firsthand to how these taxes have choked the growth of our business and negatively impacted our customers. It's a daily occurrence at our office that a representative of our member services staff has to answer the questions of an irate new customer as to why their bill is so much higher than anticipated. Although we go out of our way to post this information clearly and inform customers what their tax bill will be, even including calculators on our website so customers can figure their bill in advance, it still frequently comes as a shock. I estimate that we lose as many as one quarter of our new customers after their first trips due to the extraordinary burden of this tax. As a 100% local small business, we can ill afford this. In 2014, Car2Go brought their one-way car sharing model to the Twin Cities. This service, which allows users to pick up a car at point A, drive to point B, and leave it there, was extremely well received. But just 2 years later, in 2016, Car2Go left the market, left Minnesota altogether, citing the high motor vehicle rental taxes as their primary reason for departing. In 2017, the Shared Use Mobility Center out of Chicago was commissioned by the McKnight Foundation to prepare a Twin Cities Action Plan. One of the primary findings of this plan was that the Twin Cities transportation network has been negatively impacted by the absence of a one-way car sharing service. Among other recommendations, the action plan strongly recommended exempting car sharing operations from the motor vehicle rental tax and fee to support the growth of car sharing in Minnesota. One question that might be raised is how car sharing is substantively different from any other form of car rental. I submit that the unique car sharing model, where vehicles are immediately available for short trips in the neighborhoods where people live and work, fulfills a completely different purpose from traditional car rental. Rental car companies are not helping commuters make easier connections to bus rapid transit and light rail. Only car sharing can do that. Our hubs are deliberately located adjacent to major transit lines. Rental car companies aren't helping people in low-income neighborhoods make easier trips to the grocery store. Only car sharing can do that. Our car has intentionally placed hubs in low-income communities and lowered hourly rates at these hubs to encourage increased access. And no company looking to build a new headquarters or distribution center has ever looked at the Twin Cities and said, "Let's not go there. They don't have enough rental car companies." But we know that companies do compare the Twin Cities to Chicago and Seattle and Portland, which all have robust one-way car sharing services, and give enhanced consideration to locations that have vibrant multimodal transportation systems. Next year, in partnership with the cities of St. Paul and Minneapolis and Xcel Energy, our car will launch a new all-electric one-way car sharing service line with a fleet of 150 vehicles at 70 hubs throughout the Twin Cities. Half of these hubs will be located in ACP 50 neighborhoods, that is, areas of concentrated poverty with greater than 50% people of color. One of the goals of this public-private partnership is to make car sharing available in low-income neighborhoods and to keep prices as low as possible to make the service accessible to students, single-parent households, and people living on fixed incomes. And we're not stopping at the Twin Cities. We want to replicate what we're doing here in Duluth and Rochester and St. Cloud and elsewhere. By supporting this bill, you're not just making a tweak to a tax law. You're releasing the brake on the growth of innovative transportation solutions in our state. Thank you for considering this important bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just into the testifier, you talked about kind of our rates. You know, you mentioned we're the highest in the country. Kind of where are we, like, if we're, are we 5%, 6% higher than the next closest state? Kind of could you talk a little bit about that? And then I have a follow-up.
So we have the highest, to the best of my knowledge, we have the highest rental car tax rate in the U.S. I believe the next highest is about 12%. When you put the tax and the fee together, it's 14.3%, as was noted before. But it's also notable that in most states, car sharing is not subject to rental car taxes as they are here. So we both have the highest rental car tax and fee in the U.S. and in many places, car sharing is not subject to those taxes.
Thank you. And then
Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then kind of a follow-up to that. So from that tax rates, you think we've lost some business because of that tax rate?
Mr. Schroeder.
My apologies, Mr. Chair. I'm not as familiar with the protocol here. So, yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So the question was, have we lost business in the state as a result of that? My answer is I believe the answer is yes.
Okay.
And then, Representative Swedzinski.
And then just a final question. You mentioned that you in certain neighborhoods you have different pricing. Did I hear you correctly? So you charge differently depending on where you're from or like that?
Mr. Schroeder.
Our car maintains increased access hubs at locations that we designate to be increased access, primarily as a result of the surrounding communities being predominantly low income and diverse. So our hourly rental rates are 30% lower, for example, in communities like Phillips and Frogtown than they are in places like Loring Park or Marcy Homes.
Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to kind of understand how the car works. So let's say I take a one-way trip to, let's say I live in Phillips. I take a trip to Eden Prairie to do some shopping, and I pay one rate. Then I get back in the car in Eden Prairie. Will I pay a different rate going back?
Mr. Schroeder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To answer that question, we currently operate a round-trip car sharing service, meaning that you will always return the vehicle to the location from which you picked it up, and the rate is charged based on the location where you pick up the car. When we implement a one-way car sharing service in 2020, we will have a different pricing model, which will include a qualified low-income model as opposed to the location-based model that we use today.
Representative Swedzinski. Okay. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, too. Question revolves around, I guess, how we fund our roads and bridges, which we use a lot of what we like to say is dedicated, constitutionally dedicated funding sources. And part of the funds for the roads that these cars could be driving on is funded by gasoline taxes as well as some tap fees and also currently at least the sales tax on leased vehicles and so forth. Now with all electric vehicles, obviously that is not going to have gas tax included to that, and now you want to take away the other part of the funding for the roads and bridges. Doesn't these cars also require good roads and bridges, and how do you justify taking all the funding sources for part of the infrastructure that you require?
Mr. Schroeder.
Thank you for that question, Mr. Chair. So there a two-part answer to that. The first thing I would note is that our car is working with MnDOT currently on a distance-based user fee pilot project. We are, I think, the only car sharing company that's doing that right now. And basically the point of that project, the pilot project, which I believe just received funding within the past couple of weeks, is to examine the utility of a distance-based fee for electric vehicles, specifically to address the concern that you're raising. So we are literally at the forefront of trying to make sure that roads and bridges get funded appropriately, because that matters to us. Infrastructure, of course, matters greatly to us. The second answer to the question is that in our current model, we are, of course, paying through the gas tax. Our users are paying through their subscription fees and hourly charges, are paying for roads and bridges the way that anyone else who uses the roads and bridges and infrastructure in the state is doing. What we're saying is that car sharing is a different model from the traditional rental car structure, which is primarily companies that come from outside of the state and was intended, as my understanding, to primarily be a visitor's tax more so than a tax on residents. And that we think that the actual financial impact of this on roads and bridges is pretty negligible. I haven't seen the analysis. I tried to look that up last night. But I think it's not a very great impact.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think you kind of made the case that maybe this bill is premature until we get the other type of funding mechanism squared away. But if it's negligible in your belief, then the cost to your consumers is probably no more impactful, in my opinion. But I just am concerned the fact that we are trying to reduce, again, the amount of dollars going into our highway user distribution fund in order to fund for these programs and this infrastructure. So that's a big concern and a caution for me. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think you have a revenue note in your packet, but the impact is $80,000 in 2020 and $90,000 in revenue lost after that each year. But the benefit to the state is much higher. So we're getting a bigger return because of the benefits of car sharing. It reduces household car ownership and vehicle miles traveled, so it reduces the use on the roads. It alleviates parking and traffic congestion. It increases transportation options for those who are least likely to own a car. It keeps money circulating in the local economy rather than if you own a car paying for services for that car, that money leaves the economy. Car sharing reduces household transportation costs, making housing more affordable. I think to own a vehicle is around $9,000 a month. For car sharing, it's a few hundred dollars a month. And on environmental quality, car sharing reduces use and dependence on fossil fuels, especially if you're using hybrid and electric vehicles, and reduces greenhouse gases and particulate emissions. So there's a lot of benefits that outweigh that lost revenue of $80,000 to $90,000 per year.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. In rebuttal, though, all of those things you talk about, reducing the number of cars and so forth, also reduces the amount of dollars going into highway user tax distribution fund. So it's not an even give and take. Thank you.
Representative McDonald. Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I support the bill. Obviously, I signed on to it. I have another bill that would also reduce the sales tax on all rental cars. There's three taxes on there. So, and how much, you know, I hate to say it, but how greedy can we be? Three different taxes on rental cars? Three taxes, as if one tax wasn't enough. So for me, it's kind of a moral thing. I mean, how much do you tax a person? So I support this. But I would imagine the testifier that because you said that this tax does choke out the business, and that's evident sometimes in many of the taxes, with the increase of the gas tax, that too, wouldn't you agree, could potentially choke out your business and put a brake on your growth.
Mr. Schroeder.
So as I said before, our plan is to make a transition to an all-electric service line. And so I'm not sure what the impact of an increase in the gas tax will be. A lot will depend fundamentally on how we, what decisions are made about how to recover revenue from electric vehicles going forward, which I think there should be a good plan and a robust plan to do that. That's why we're participating in the MnDOT study. But I would say, yes, that anything that increases costs that we then, in effect, have to pass along to consumers does, in fact, make our business model more challenging.
Representative McDonald.
And just last, I think we have a testifier that's going to come up and testify. But just for the record, obviously you see the House research, the 6.875% tax, then on top of that a 9.2% tax, and then on top of that a 5% tax. I mean, where does it end? And I do travel around the country and rent cars for my business, and I pay the tax. That's fine. It's a lot of out-of-towners that pay it, so the heck with it. We'll stick them. But there are other options. There are other options for consumers, and taxes do drive your habits and life. So this is a good example, good policy to reduce this burden and encourage businesses to grow and encourage people to do rideshare.
Representative Brand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. You had talked about your rideshare service and vehicles off the road, that sort of thing. Do you have any way of tracking how many vehicles your service takes out of the equation, or how many pounds of carbon is being reduced, or anything like that that shows some sort of I'm just kind of curious from the environmental standpoint, because $80,000 in taxes is not a lot when you talk about the overall tax of revenue and that sort of thing in Minnesota. But what kind of environmental benefits, what kind of tangible benefits does something like this provide for rideshare service in Minnesota?
Mr. Schroeder.
Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, I'd like to give a very quick response to that and also invite Will Schroer of East Metro Strong to say a word to that because he has prepared talking points to that.
Okay.
But what I can say is that studies have shown that for every car-sharing vehicle that's put into service, it takes 9 to 13 personally owned vehicles off the road.
Wow.
So there are significant environmental benefits, and we know based on studies primarily coming out of the Transportation Studies Center at UC Berkeley, that households that live near a fixed car sharing hub are less likely to own a vehicle. They reduce their overall vehicle miles traveled, or VMT. They reduce their carbon and particulates and general emissions profile significantly. Will, did you want to speak to that?
I think we've got four more on the list, and then we'll go to the next testifier. So Representative Erickson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Mr. Schroeder, you're a nonprofit, so do you get any other benefits as a nonprofit that would reduce your tax impact?
Mr. Schroeder.
Oh, yes, that's a very good question. So we, as a nonprofit, are exempt currently from the 5% rental fee. So we are not impacted by the fee. We are impacted by the 9.3% tax, however. In some sense, one could say that gives us a kind of competitive advantage, because all for-profit companies would then be paying 5% more than we are. But we think that eliminating both the tax and the fee, which in effect levels the playing field and eliminates our current competitive advantage, is good for the community, is good for Minnesota, and is the right thing to do.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And that was my concern was the same as Representative Erickson's, but I was actually thinking I like tax policy that advantages nonprofits as opposed to for-profits. And I see this as a really major growth industry. I can't wait till we get driverless cars and there's more incentive for even more people to share cars and vehicles. But the nonprofit providers in general, just like our car, have really shown a greater commitment to serving communities that have people of lesser means, locating them in neighborhoods that just are not profitable. When we did have the for-profit car to go in Minneapolis, I can tell you there were only certain, then they kept narrowing where those cars were available, and they cut out most of ordinary people in favor of the higher income communities within the city of Minneapolis. And so I think as this moves forward, we should think about whether we want to retain that advantage for a nonprofit provider, because I really do think they try and make sure that all people have access, as opposed to, at least in the demonstration that we've had in the city of Minneapolis, that was our experience.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just reading through the underlying statute, too, and that 5% you're exempt from is the one that usually rental cars can retain to pay for their licenses and tabs, which you probably still have to buy, right?
Mr. Schroeder.
Yes, that's correct.
So you're forgoing a tax benefit that you could have to retain to pay for those.
Mr. Schroeder.
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as I was looking at this, I was kind of thinking again about the other benefits that we get from this. And so I pulled up the map of where the hubs are, and a lot of them are located along the LRT routes. And I imagine it's programs like this that are going to help people maybe make that shift to not owning a car, or maybe a family owning one car instead of two cars. And so you're there really is this benefit. You're cutting down on the wear and tear on the roads because you're cutting down on the number of cars on the road because it's allowing people to make that choice to use the LRT as much as they can, you know, and the train costs the same to run, whether there are two people on that car or there are 20 people on that train car. And so I imagine that's a hard thing to measure, but I mean, we know that that's how people's habits work. And so I think they're $80,000 really isn't a lot in the grand scheme of tax policy. You know, and this, that doesn't even kind of touch on the climate change impact of encouraging more people to not own cars that they're driving every single day. So I think this is great. I wish that we could expand it further to, you know, communities like the community I represent. And I imagine if we make it easier for you to do that, are there plans to expand further as things get rolling?
Mr. Schroeder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the answer is yes. So when we do our expansion from our current 60-vehicle fleet to 150 vehicles, we will be expanding in significantly into some new neighborhoods. I believe you represent Roseville. So we're not moving to Roseville yet. But what we do know from some of our GPS data is that a lot of people make a lot of trips to Roseville. So that's definitely a market that we are looking at seriously. We do want to expand. We do want to grow. We think, as I said before, that this will take the brake off of car sharing and other innovative transportation solutions in the state. And I would say, again, that we deliberately position our vehicles in self-serve kiosks where in real time people can reserve those vehicles as part of their daily transportation solution in a way that they would never do with a traditional rental car strategy. That's why we think our model is so different. We are deliberately making the choice to serve and be present in lower-income neighborhoods, which is something else that makes our model different. To my knowledge, there's no studies that demonstrate the kind of pro-social benefits that car sharing has, similarly for more traditional rental car situations. It's just a different model.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, because, I mean, when you look at the – and it's not just to be clear, folks aren't familiar with the Metro Transit bus routes. You know, it's not just the train routes either. I see there's several of them around the three route, and I'm guessing those are the routes most used by students, which totally – I mean, that makes sense to me. I just think there's a lot of good that can be done here, especially when we're building more of our affordable housing closer to those transit lines. I mean, this is part of that whole system of making our communities more accessible. So thank you.
Question, Mr. Schroeder, so what would the rate be like for an hour, a range of rates for if that was the car share for an hour or a day? What would the rates be?
Mr. Chair, we have a variety of different rate plans. It depends on whether you're a student or an individual. In general, our most popular plan, members pay $8.95 per hour to use the vehicle, and that they can pay by the quarter hour. So their reservations are divisible into quarter hours. You can pay in 15-minute increments.
Mr. Schroeder, does that include the gas?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it does.
All right.
And insurance.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Fabian, final question for Mr. Schroeder or comment.
Well, Mr. Chair, this whole discussion opens up so many questions from my mind. And I don't know how much time you want to take on this, but I've just got a whole
host of things. We can have more. We've got, take some testifiers. Yeah, you bet. We'll move with testifiers. You want to hear some testifiers first?
I'd be happy to do whichever way you want to go.
Let's do that, and then we'll come back and kind of save questions. So, Mr. Schroeder, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we'll move to the next testifier there, and then we'll open up to some more. So if you'd please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Will Schroer. I'm the Executive Director of East Metro Strong. We are a public-private partnership dedicated to improving transportation options for everyone on the East eastern half of the metro, but really the region as a whole. Our members include Washington and Ramsey counties as counties, six East Metro cities and large employers, including Health East, 3M, and the many thousands of employers that belong to the St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce. And we're all working together to improve transportation options, as I say, in the East Metro. Our members asked me to work with our car and with the City of St. Paul, who, as you may have seen in the paper, applied to the Met Council for some funding to assist with the startup of the network that was described. And my members asked me to do that because they saw firsthand some of the effects that Mr. Schroeder was talking about. Their employers are having difficulty in some cases. Folks will come in from the suburbs, for example. They don't want to drive every day to work necessarily because 99% of the time they don't need their car at work and it's expensive to pay for parking, et cetera. Sometimes they need to run errands. Sometimes they need to go home. Sometimes they need to go shopping, et cetera, during the day. This kind of network serves those purposes, whether one lives in the core service area or not. And so, again, the Washington County representative on my board was very, very excited about this prospect and asked me to work closely with the City of St. Paul and with our car to support this effort. As you may have seen, we're successful. And my message to you here this morning is just to back up Mr. Schroeder's testimony and add to that the voice of the business community and local governments saying that this is a need and to move on this bill would help support an effort that is as recognized as necessary by a lot of different folks. So you're having great discussion. I think it's really interesting. Mr. Schroeder referred to some work that I had done helping to analyze the benefits of this kind of work. I would underline the statistic that he gave, Representative Brand, that these services really replace a lot of other personal and institutional spending because folks and institutions don't have to own their own cars, whether it's personal cars or fleet vehicles. They can use these cars instead. So it frees up personal and institutional money, and it frees up folks' time and effort because they have something that is available to them when they need it, but not a burden to them when they don't need it. And the statistics that have come out of places that do have these are really remarkable to me. I will say, when I first started looking at this kind of program, I was curious if it wouldn't actually maybe have counterintuitive impacts where now that cars were easily available, people would drive more, right? But that's not what works out. Statistically, that is actually not what happens. Folks drive when they need to, and additional locations are opened up to them that they can't necessarily reach. Someone that lives in St. Paul and needs to go shopping at Roseville Center, now it's very difficult for them, and now it would be open to them. And that opens up opportunities and economic activity to folks in a way that our current system doesn't allow. So I and my board are big fans of this and urge your strong consideration. And thanks for the robust discussion around this. I hope I can contribute. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Schroeder. So I'm going to open this up to Representative Schultz, you have another testifier? Okay. So, yes. So I'm anyone who would care to testify for or against House File 1357? And whoever wants to go first, please state your name and please proceed.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Todd Hill with Hill Capital Strategies, and I'm here on behalf of my client, Enterprise Rent-A-Car, and I have with me Mackenzie Spaulding, who is the head of government affairs for Enterprise, who I'll turn over in just a couple seconds and give some more background on Enterprise. I think you'll be excited to hear that Enterprise offers many of the exact same services that our car offers. We offer hourly rental. We offer fleet services. We offer a variety of ways to deal with customers. The challenge, and actually we agree with the proponents of this bill, rental car taxes in Minnesota are way too high. The airport rental car tax is 44%. We lose lots of business every day to Uber and Lyft and other types of transportation because our rental car taxes are too high, and our taxes in the cities are equally high. The challenge with this bill, it's very similar to the other debates that this legislature has been having over the last few years. It's similar to the Uber and Lyft argument or fight with cab drivers. It's similar to the Airbnb fight with hotel owners. And this is rental car companies. It is the use of new technologies and companies that want to enter the marketplace and get an advantage over the traditional company. And they want to do that by changing taxes or changing regulations. And that's the challenge with this bill. We agree that the rental car taxes are too high. We employ 1,000 people and have 67 locations in the state of Minnesota. We plate more cars than any other entity in the state. We've had more challenges with Minlars than anyone that's plated a car in this state. We are dedicated to this state. We try to do the right thing. But what is happening here is our competitors are asking for a tax break. We would be fine if everyone could have that tax break, but if you just, it doesn't seem to us to be fair to give our competitor a tax advantage over us. And I'll turn it over to McKinsey. You can talk more about it.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. Please state your name and welcome.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Mackenzie Spaulding, and as Todd mentioned, I'm with Enterprise Holdings, which represents Enterprise National and Alamo, in opposition of House File 1357. So Enterprise rent a car, and we've heard a lot about it today. Pretty self-explanatory. We rent cars. We do a lot more than that. We operate a car sales division, a leasing division, truck rental, exotic rental, a van pooling division where employers or individuals can choose to pool together on a daily basis and limit the number of cars on the road called commute. We also offer all other types of rental, monthly, weekly, daily, hourly, along with a car sharing company called Enterprise Car Share. So when people think of car rental, we often think only of airports, and that misperception, it was mentioned today, is one reason we have the high rental car tax rate that we do. Minnesota has one of the highest rental car tax rates in the country with our 9.2% rental car tax added to all the other taxes we've heard. It's over 22% in the local markets and over 40% at the airport. The special tax started in 91 at 6.2% to temporarily fund the Super Bowl, and 4 or 5 years ago an additional 3% was added, so we were here testifying against that each time, the issue remains the same. The tax is very high. The idea of car rental happening exclusively at the airports couldn't be further from the truth, as Todd mentioned. We have over 60 locations in Minnesota. We employ 1,000 people, and we handle Minnesota consumers in need of rental vehicles. Many of our locations are in the metro area. However, we have great representation in greater Minnesota as well. Duluth, Hibbing, Rochester, Marshall, Wilmer, Fargo-Moorhead, just to name a few. So Enterprise has built their business on these local customer needs, and these temporary replacement or convenience-driven rentals still make up a majority of our business in Minnesota and around the country. So with technology, like many other industries, the rental car world is changing. There are more ways of operating rental car companies now than ever before. For example, the more traditional car rental, the daily, weekly, monthly, or hourly car sharing operated by companies. And now peer-to-peer car rentals, where an individual decides to rent their personal vehicle or a small fleet of vehicles to other individuals in need. We all attempt to differentiate ourselves against the other and offer different offerings, whether it's customer pickup, cars parked around the city, a hub-and-spoke model, the Emerald Isle delivery. That said, we're in the same business. We all rent cars. With the evolving industry, we need more help now than ever before to ensure these transactions are treated the same versus putting laws in place that carve out one very specific type of rental customer that wouldn't be affected by this large tax burden. I say we need your help now on this issue because we'll likely be talking about another bill this session that instead of focusing on a carve-out for a specific type of customer, focuses on ensuring all rental car transactions are taxed the same, whether it's the type of rental we're talking about today or the peer-to-peer car rental companies I mentioned previously, as they're not paying any of these high rental car taxes in the state of Minnesota. This same language was heard on the Senate side last session. We also spoke with Representative Omar, who carried this bill last session as well. Both House and Senate authors agreed that the bill, as written, didn't include everything it needed to, and that there were a lot of other types of rental that should be considered. I don't know how to decide that someone who's in need of a vehicle for an hour or 3 hours is it more in need of a customer who's been in an accident, a local Minnesota consumer who's been in an accident and has to have their car repaired and is, you know, forced to pay all of these taxes as well. So with that, I'm here today in opposition of House File 1357, not because we don't full-heartedly agree that the tax rate is way too high. We do. We have the same conversations with customers that have sticker shock about the, you know, the daily rate that they hear and the total bill at the end of the day. We'd be testifying in support of this bill if it was to result in equal or reduced taxation for rental car customers and companies. However, the tax rate's too high for all rental car customers, and all companies or individuals renting cars should be held to the same standard, especially taxation. So we, for that reason, we ask that you oppose House File 1357.
Thank you. Representative Fabian, did you want to ask questions or wait till all the testifiers are done?
Whatever pleases the chair.
Okay, I think we'll finish with the testifiers and then we'll go to you. So anyone you. Have a question? Representative Gomez.
Yeah. thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, I actually didn't know that you know, traditional rental companies offered hourly service. I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about that, about the price of the service per hour.
Yeah.
Ms. Balding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So any of our locations around the metro offer a variety of different options. So you can walk in or schedule a rental and pay. We have hourly rates, we have daily rates, and so one of the questions was just how much, you know, per hour to the other person testifying. So we, our rate structures vary as well, but you can rent a car on a daily basis for $9.99 some days, $20 some days, and hourly rates, obviously based on the daily rate, hourly rates are prorated based on that number.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what do you mean by prorated? They wouldn't be a 24th of $10, presumably, to rent a car for an hour. Like, can you just give me a ballpark of what the actual cost per hour is, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it varies, again, based on the rate, but on the daily rate, but it can be $6.99 per hour. It can be $12.99 per hour, really based on not necessarily the neighborhood, but the day of the week. We have a very high peak and valley as far as rental needs, and just supply and demand of specific locations.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so do you guys have a like a membership model like the other services that they talked about do, where, you know, where you can ensure that you have access to that vehicle at the rate, or no?
Ms. Balding.
Mr. Chair, we have our car share, enterprise car share model does have a membership model. Our local locations around Minnesota have there's business rental, corporate rental plans that have memberships per se, in that those all rates, your rate plan is available to you whatever day of the week, whenever. Outside of that, there are, you know, different codes that you can use to have discounted rate structures available to you, but our regular local branches don't have a membership model.
So, Representative Gomez, do you have other questions other than the rates? I mean, they're not necessarily here for, I mean, we're talking a tax portion of.
Sure. Yeah, I'm just, I mean, I'm interested in the, Gomez. Yeah, Mr. Chair. So, can individuals be part of the car share pool?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Mr. Spalding. Chair, sorry. Yes, absolutely.
And Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
And so, in my community, there are a lot of people who are transit dependent. And so, you know, this service, especially the kind of one-way service where you can pick up a car that's really just like right in your neighborhood, like on a block, kind of, you can find it on an app, like that there's one sort of close by.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of enables people to, you know, to kind of just more seamlessly live a car-free lifestyle, whether that's because of economic necessity or out of, you know, kind of a personal choice. And so to me, like, the fact that that sort of that fluency in terms of like the places where you can pick up one way or cars for one way trips, or the location of hubs near transit, which, you know, represent huge public investment, right, in kind of creating alternatives to, you know, solo car trips. Represent sort of one of the unique aspects, I think, of this model. And so I wonder if you can speak to that, because, you know, I know there is an enterprise location that's pretty close to my district, but you know, it, even just like getting to a rental car spot, do they have a car? You have to have a major credit card. You know, there are sort of some barriers that exist for rental cars that don't exist for this other model. And so I wonder if you can speak to that, like the location issue.
Representative Gomez, I think you kind of prove our point. There are a variety of rental car companies that exist that all meet different needs. Enterprise's background, they started as a company that was a replacement vehicle company. If you got in an accident and you needed a replacement vehicle, Enterprise picked you up, brought you to their shop, gave you a car, and that's how the Enterprise got their start. They were primarily a neighborhood car rental company that dealt with replacement vehicles. They have expanded into car sharing. My daughter actually works for Enterprise. I'm very proud of her. Just got a promotion. She is building their corporate carpooling operation now for Enterprise, convincing businesses to use their fleet services to have their employees come into their job locations. They have a variety of services. I think that's our point. Our car has a unique model that's unique to them. We have car rentals on campus, hourly car rentals on campuses and a variety of campuses around the state where you buy a membership and you can use the car. We all have a different approach to the market, and all we're saying is we ought to all be taxed the same. We agree the taxes are way too high in Minnesota. It costs all of us business. But our concern is if you start to give our competitors a tax advantage because we're the traditional company and we maybe don't look the same as them, we provide many of the same services. We are in many of the same neighborhoods. We all have a unique product. We ought to just be taxed the same. And I think that's what we're asking for today is that the tax parity remain the same.
Representative Gomez?
That's good, Mr.
Chair. Okay, I've got two more on the list, and then we're going to Representative Erickson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Compared, though, to a nonprofit, your for-profit has other federal and state code tax obligations. So would you just point out maybe briefly what those are?
Mr. Hill? Or
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, as a corporation, we certainly pay, you know, all the corporate taxes that are required. The 5% fee that was brought up earlier, that is actually a tax that the rental car companies asked for. And that allows us to recoup the cost of our plates in the state of Minnesota. And just so everyone understands how that works, that 5% tax is applied. It's a line item on every transaction. And part of that is to deal with some of our corporate rental rates that are determined at the national level. And because we have higher plate costs here as well, we came to the legislature and asked for that fee to be placed as a line item on our invoice. So it is a fee that is paid. That money is used to offset our plate costs. Anything that we collect in excess of our plate cost is remitted to the state. So either way, the state really is getting that entire 5% because it's what we use to pay for our plates, and then any excess is remitted to the state as well. But we have all the other corporate taxes that you would have to pay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think, you know, to get us back to kind of tax policy, I think often about the way that different policies impact different people and how those kind of layer on top of each other. And I was wondering, you know, it sounds like, you know, we're trying to say that our car and what you guys do is the same, but my understanding is that there are different requirements or that you have different age requirements and that there might be additional fees for younger folks. And so if you look at our car, it looks like their market is a lot of younger folks and students. And so if they're, I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So our car share model has the same requirements that an our car would as far as age. Each company, Enterprise is here talking about this today, but there are a ton of other rental companies represented in Minnesota. Hertz, Choice, a local company. Also, everyone agrees, you know, a rental is a rental is a rental on this. Each company, though, has different age requirements and different fees associated with renting. So Enterprise and Hertz and Avis may be the largest companies that people would think of have different requirements and different, if there would be fees, different fees associated with renting if you are underage. And so I guess just to the point that everyone has a different model of operating, you know, Representative Gomez, if you need a car in an area that takes a little while to get to an enterprise location, we pick you up, just like having a convenient car parked, you know, right around the corner. So there's a lot of different ways to meet that customer need, and each company handles it differently, if that answers the question.
Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I won't belabor it any further except to say that you do have to be 21. I mean, this is on your website. You have to be 21, and there's an extra $20 per day fee if you're 21 to 24. And so, you know, that is part of when we think of who's benefiting from which proposal. You know, we think young folks often don't have the extra money, and so. Just kind of wanted to make that point about how these businesses aren't all the same in who's benefiting and who's not. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep. Thank you. Ms. Balding.
And just to that, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, again, the ages that you talked about are 60-plus locations around Minnesota. There is a different age range for car sharing, and there is a different range for our replacement customers. You only need to be 18 years old to rent a car if you have a claim on your personal vehicle in the state of Minnesota. And so depending on your rental scenario, a business rental customer is 21. So there's differences, and we go down as low as 18 years old with an open claim on your vehicle.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify for or against House File 1357? Thank you. So I've got two people on the list, and Representative Fabian, I'm going to let you go last here because you've been, unless you want to go first. Representative Fabian, go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schultz, I think you said in your testimony that it costs $9,000 per month to own a car. Is that correct?
Up to.
Representative Schultz.
Up to.
I guess it depends on what kind of vehicle you're buying.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Fabian.
Well, that's over $100,000 a year. I don't know what kind of cars you drive, Mr. Chair, but it doesn't cost me anywhere near that. I'd like to have Mr. Schroeder come back down, if you would, please.
Yes, and Mr. Schroeder?
I can start out by saying, listen, I appreciate, you know, the whole idea, the whole concept of providing vehicles for people. That's part of capitalism. But... Mr. Schroeder, you said that you currently have, or you're going to transition to 150 cars. You're a nonprofit. How many cars do you currently have?
Mr. Schroeder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe it's 57 in our fleet currently.
Representative Fee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And now you're going to transition to 150 electric cars next year. As a nonprofit, how are those cars financed?
Mr. Schroeder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We created a public-private partnership with Xcel Energy, with the City of St. Paul and the City of Minneapolis. Xcel Energy, we created a project called the EV Community Mobility Project. Xcel Energy committed $4 million for make-ready construction for the project. Make-ready, the easiest way to describe it is everything underground for the infrastructure, so the cuts, the cabling, the transformer upgrades, and so forth. We applied to the regional solicitation of the Metropolitan Council and were awarded in January an additional $4 million matching Xcel's investment, which was awarded to the City of St. Paul, which will be used for the purchase of the electric vehicles and for other multimodal elements. It's a $10.6 million total project, and we are working on raising the last $2.6 million that we have. So we have $8 million in hand, and we're still working on the last $2.6 million. So we've basically raised capital assets for this project through a public-private partnership and intend to launch in 2020. Did that answer your question?
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, it does. So, and again, I'm not critical of what you're attempting to do, but, Mr. Chair and members, I don't know where XL's revenue is coming from to come up with $4 million for this project. I'm assuming it's going to fall on the backs of ratepayers. And the $4 million that comes from the Met Council, I don't know where that's coming from, but I'm guessing that that's going to fall on the backs of taxpayers. So, and again, Mr. Schroeder, I'm not being critical of what you're attempting to do, but I do have some serious questions. How do you, if someone signs up or they buy a membership and they want to use a car, how do you know that that person is a licensed driver?
Mr. Schroeder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We use a service to check people's MMR, their driving record, to ensure that they are, in fact, a licensed driver and that they do not have DUIs or major moving violations with according to a schedule that we've worked out with our insurance company, since we do, in fact, cover the insurance for the vehicles.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so then data privacy, data security, you know, their driver's license information and so forth. How do you assure that?
Mr. Schroeder.
We have our own internal policies. We work with MNLARS. We understand the data privacy and other concerns. We have strict protocols in place to ensure that that people's data is protected.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And then in terms of liability, if there's an accident, property damage, personal injury, death, you cover all the insurance on that, or would that fall on somebody else's homeowner's insurance?
Mr. Schroeder.
We cover liability insurance. We cover all of that. We also cover damage to the vehicle, with the exception that there is a deductible that members are liable to pay if they are found to be at fault in doing damage to one of our vehicles. Members can purchase a waiver in order to avoid that, which costs $50 plus $10 additional for each household member.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schroeder, I live 360 miles from the Capitol. If I want to sign up for your program and drive to Roseau this weekend, or if someone wants to go to Moorhead or Dilworth or Aurora, is that service available to us?
Mr. Schroeder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You would have to pick up the vehicle at one of our hubs, but you can rent a car in addition to renting it for as little as half an hour. You can rent it for up to 3 days. One of the things that we have emphasized with regard to the service that we are creating, the EV Community Mobility Service, is that this isn't just a service for the Twin Cities, because there are many, many people like yourself who commute to the Twin Cities through various means, with or without a personally owned vehicle, but then may need other mobility solutions while they're in the Twin Cities. So people who are coming in using various forms of transit can pick up a car for an hour and take it and use it. And in the new one-way model that we're proposing, that will get a lot easier.
Representative Fabian, have you got just
I'll finish up real quick.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. So, you know, again, I'm not opposed to the general concept that we're trying to do, but I'd like to see the playing field more level. And Mr. Schroeder, I want to thank you. You talked about in your opening comments about the high taxes and so forth. And I've heard comments from other people in this body about high taxes and the effect that they do or don't have. But in your words, you said that the high tax has choked the growth of our business, your business. You said that this is an extraordinary burden. This tax is an extraordinary burden. It's the primary reason for some businesses leaving Minnesota. And if we were to reduce this tax, you said it would be releasing the brake on growth. Members, this is what I've been talking about for 8 years. We need to level the playing field. And I appreciate your comments. I'm not opposed necessarily to what you're trying to do. But, Mr. Chair, I think we need to have a more level playing field. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Schultz, closing comments.
Thank you. And I rarely make mistakes, but it's $9,000 per year, not per month. Yeah, so sorry about that confusion.
Representative Schultz, closing comments.
I just want to thank the members of the committee. I think that if they meet the definition of car sharing, then they should get the benefits of a reduced tax form. So if enterprise, part of their company, can meet the definition of car sharing, then they would qualify for the reductions in the tax rate if this goes forward. So thank you, members of the committee, for all of your interesting questions. I appreciate your time.
Very good. Representative Schultz renews her motion to lay over House File 1357 for possible inclusion into the tax omnibus bill. Thank you, members. So, Representative Petersburg, before we go to Representative Dabney's bill, is your testifier here? Or okay. So I want to ask right now on House File 1083, which is Representative Petersburg bill, is there anyone here in the audience that is here to testify for or against? Because we're not going to get to that today. But you can testify if you want. Seeing none, Representative Dabney will make sure your testifier is heard. So would someone like to move House File 1073?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lean moves House File 1073 for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill. Representative Dabney, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been enjoyable to sit in the audience and watch you folks work. I miss the Tax Committee. I kind of wanted to raise my hand and ask a couple of questions. Particularly, I've carried legislation for our car in past years, so I was listening to that debate particularly closely. But today, with House File 1073, I want to shift the conversation to the affordability of higher education. To grab Representative Fabian's language, level the playing field, depending on what sort of post-secondary opportunities an individual chooses to pursue. Lots of Minnesotans are challenged and burdened by the cost of higher education. House File 1073 would reduce the cost of post-secondary education to more students by eliminating the sales tax on materials required by schools for courses. As more jobs require some sort of post-secondary education, a small provision like this can have a powerful message to students of the state that we support their efforts. The current statute exempting instructional materials from sales taxes includes an illustrative list. This sort of thing is this and this and this is exempt from sales taxes. Unfortunately, the good people of the Department of Revenue have decided that that illustrative list is instead exhaustive and have stopped there. This tends to bias the sales tax exemption then towards traditional academic courses. Your books are tax exempt, but then biasing against those that have a those courses that are more hands-on in their course of study and in the materials required. House File 1073 then would ask for a more comprehensive approach for those taking a more hands-on course of study. With me today, Mr. Chair, is Carrie Pallava from the Centerpoint Massage and Shiatsu Therapy School and Clinic, who can share that schools and their students' experience with the interpretation of statute today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Pallava, please state your name and begin with your testimony. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I am Carrie Johnson Pallava, owner and director of Centerpoint Massage and Shiatsu Therapy School and Clinic in St. Louis Park. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you this morning. I am in support of this bill, House File 1073, due to the experience that I had with the Department of Revenue and the issue of the interpretation of instructional materials. Several years ago, I had the pleasure of experiencing a sales tax audit. Was not my first. However, through the most recent audit, we learned several new things. We had known for years that students were exempt from paying sales tax on instructional materials. And during the most recent audit, we learned that instructional materials meant only textbooks, written materials, or the electronic equivalent. This law and interpretation is very generous for students of academia, for those who attend traditional colleges and universities. But what about our students who attend vocational education? Vocational education plays a very important role in our state and country. Vocational education teaches skills to students who are then very employable after the completion of a program. Programs tend to be shorter and less expensive than a four-year college. Students who are not college-bound often obtain the skills for a career through vocational education programs. Students can start a career right away upon completing their program. My Massage School is an accredited vocational training program school and has a 98% placement rate. Vocational education teaches skills as well as knowledge. In order to learn and develop the skills, students need to purchase equipment and supplies and practice at home. And what's really important as it is practice outside of the classroom. Our school does purchase all the tables for in-classroom practice and demonstration, but the students must practice at home. And if any of you receive massage therapy on a regular basis, you will appreciate the rigorous education of institutions that require their students to practice at home. Our students practice 3 to 4 bodywork sessions every week. They need to purchase a massage table, shiatsu mat, lotions, and linens at the beginning of their education. They are unable to practice their skills without proper equipment. They're unable to practice their skills safely without proper equipment. We teach the sciences with a kinesthetic model. Our students build the human musculature out of clay on a skeleton, and so they learn the layering of the muscular system, which demonstrates muscles that are deep and intrinsic and which muscles are superficial. And again, you would want your massage therapist to know the difference. We teach shiatsu, which is a therapeutic form of bodywork from Japan. Shiatsu is based on the same foundational theories as acupuncture. Our students are required to purchase a 24-inch model of a human body with the map of the acupoints on it, and this supports our students to be able to learn the 700 acupoints on a 3D model. All of these equipment and supplies that I've mentioned, tables and models and clay models, are currently taxable. Our students must pay sales tax on all of their equipment and supplies. Students who attend vocational schools are often low-income students. They are not being given the same tax opportunity as students of academia. Students choosing vocational education for their career in life are at an economic disadvantage. Therefore, I find a bias in the current interpretation of instructional materials to favor academia and to discriminate against the students of vocational education. Skill development is essential and cannot be done without the appropriate equipment and supplies. I understand that the Department of Revenue believes that students use the same equipment in their professional practice and therefore should be taxed. However, I need to say this is not so. Employers such as Massage Envy and many other employers of massage therapists do not require that the massage therapist provide their own table. The table that a student uses for massage practice during school may not be used in their professional practice. This is also true of the clay skeletal model and other required equipment and supplies. It is also important to note that when students pay sales tax on required equipment and supplies, they are using their own federal and state loan and grant funds to pay the Minnesota sales tax. This increases every student's loan debt. I am here because I see an ethical bias in our tax law. There's no advantage to my school in any way for expanding what is tax exempt for students. The students need to purchase the materials regardless, and currently they have to pay the sales tax. All students in Minnesota who are currently enrolled in a course of study that trains them for future employment must pay sales tax on the required equipment and supplies needed to complete a course of study.
Ms. Palava, we've got one more testifier for sure, and you're making excellent points. Could you just kind of wrap this up?
I
apologize. Thank you very much.
This is unfair and out of line with Minnesota's intent to support education and creates an unfair tax burden to the student. It is unfair to the student who chooses vocational education over academic education. So I support House File 1073.
Ms. Plava,
thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And I apologize. We're just running against it. And we had a lot of discussion on the last bill, but excellent points.
I'm passionate. What
you are very good. Thank you.
There's nothing like a sales tax audit to get somebody going, Mr. Chair.
So I know we have the Department of Revenue, and while Department of Revenue is coming down, is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify on this bill? And then we have one question or comment from a legislator, and then we'll have closing comments and proceed from there. So, Ms. Bears? Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joanna Bears. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. As written, this proposal raises administrative concerns as well as problems for retailers. It will be difficult for retailers to determine who qualifies and what qualifies for the exemption. Individuals would use an exemption form at retail stores to purchase items exempt from sales tax. The retail stores may make the entire purchase of the instructional materials along with any other items exempt from sales tax as well. This bill also expands the exemption of instructional materials from items that are consumable to equipment and tools, and then equipment and tools may be used for years after the completion of the degree or the certificate. In practice, most items in statute are sold by the school. For purposes of administration and preventing the misuse of the certificate form, we would really like to work with the author to consider including the requirement that these tools and equipment to be sold by the school or by a retailer who has an agreement with the school. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative McDonald?
Well, we're out of time, Mr. Chair, so I'll just make it real brief. Okay. In Ms. Dalton, or just curious, in this bill, would this also include, you know, your photographers, graphic designers who are purchasing paper, film, ink, cameras, et cetera?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, to the extent that they are taking a photography class, anything that they would have to purchase for that photography class if it was part of a degree granting program, yes.
Okay, then just real quick. So then your testimony then from the Department of Revenue, that the fear would be that those folks would use those tools after their degree. In many cases, those degrees will transfer into their careers, and they'll still use those tools. And in their careers, they're also tax exempt, depending on so. In that scenario, you probably would change your opinion because those careers and schools become careers, and then they're still tax exempt when they're doing their business. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So thank you, Ms. Bears. Any response to that?
No response.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. You would.
I've got 7 seconds, Mr. Chair.
You do. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much. I'm glad to work with the department on problem solving. Problems should be solved, not presented as barriers. So if we can work together, I'm glad to do it. Thank you for your time and consideration today, Mr. Chair.
Chair Dabney, thank you for bringing this forward. And Representative Lean renews his motion to lay over House File 1073 for possible inclusion into the tax omnibus bill. Members, we will hear, if that's all right, Representative Petersburg, House File 1083 tomorrow. Would that be all right? Very good. Thank you, members. We are adjourned. Yep.